morning, everybody. Gosh, we got a crowd in here. Let's see what time it is. It is. This meeting is called to order November 3rd, 2010, at about 9:10 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551, Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Before I turn the meeting over to Chairman Falcone on finance, I want to mention that for those of you who are here for regarding item number two, the Val Verde County Land Project, Devil's River State Natural Area Property Exchange, and the Conservation Committee, which was going to be later this morning, but that particular item will be heard after we return from executive session after lunch. So I don't know if there's anybody here this morning for that. We won't be talking about that at all until after lunch this afternoon. Also concerning that item, for tomorrow, the action item it was to be voted on has been withdrawn from Thursday's agenda. So we will not be voting on it tomorrow. It will not be an action item tomorrow. I just want to let everybody know that in case there's anybody here for that particular item. So with that, we will begin with the Finance Committee. Chairman Falcone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes from the August 25th meeting, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Billings?
Second.
Hickson? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Committee item number one, update on Texas Parks and Wildlife Department progress in implementing the Department Land and Water Resource Conservation Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We don't have any specific reports on any of the action items and specific deliverables at this meeting. There are just a couple of things I want to bring to your attention. For those of you who have not been to Sea Center, I hope you will go post-haste. That is one of our flagship sites inside the agency there at Lake Jackson. We've got a wonderful hatchery there, but just as importantly, we have an extraordinary education and outreach center there in which we get 60 to 65,000 visitors a year to come learn about fisheries and fisheries management and aquatic resources. Really, really special. And we kicked off the year certainly on a good foot. September 1st, we welcomed our 1 millionth visitor into Sea Center since its inception. Fitting that it was a young man, Jacob Thomas, 7 years of age. So we're hitting our demographic, which ain't bad. And he was appropriately rewarded. Dow, a longstanding partner there, gave young Jacob a lifetime membership to the Coastal Conservation Association. So off to a good start there. Also got a customized rod and reel. And got a fishing license. So CCA made a contribution to it, and Dow, and then John Regnier gave him the customized rod and reel. So not bad for young Jacob. Good way to start off our fishing
year.
He's
a happy camper.
So absolutely. So he's a lifetime fisherman. So good stuff. And then just two quick updates. Y'all have been, I think, at Burton to the development of our new automated business software, a way for us to absolutely do a better job kind of managing the agency's finance, help account for our multi-fund accounting, good fiscal controls. The team, really under Gene's leadership, has been working on that for several years now. That Oracle eBay system was officially rolled out at the first of the year and working through that, and so glad to see that up and running. Obviously, we'll continue to work to perfect that system over the next year. Also, you know, I think most of y'all are aware that we have a very unique customer call center that our state parks team operates. It's a wonderful group of men and women who take and make reservations for customers that want to go visit our state parks. Those colleagues are just extraordinary and really have done a magnificent job. They all make sure that they get out and actually visit the state parks so that they're speaking from experience, and if a place is booked up, they can make alternative suggestions as to where folks ought to go. So really doing a nice job since we went live with Tex Parks through September 30th. I think they've taken over 184,000 calls. About a third of those have resulted in reservations, not only for our parks, but we also take reservations for LCRA parks and also sell off-highway vehicle decals. So the team's doing a great job on that, Chairman, and just wanted to report on their prowess and progress. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. The second item is the proposed stamp and print artwork program. Mrs. Frances Stiles and Mr. Martinwood, would you please come up to make your presentation?
Good morning. My name is Frances Stiles. I'm with the Administrative Resources Division. Each year, the Commission has the artwork provided by Collectors Covey that is presented for review. This artwork is then turned into prints by Collectors Covey and marketed and sold there. We also, Parks and Wildlife, uses the images to create a collector's stamp edition that is sold. And Mr. Wood is here to introduce each of the pieces of artwork for your review.
Thank you, Francis. Mr. Chairman, Commission, this is the 31st year that I've come down and presented the art. You know, my whole life has passed before me, you know, centered around the presentation of the stamp prints.
This is the one day you look forward to.
Yeah, I know, it really is. I didn't realize when we did this, started this 31 years ago, that this is what I would, sort of depressing when you really think about it, but this is my life, and so be it. We have now paid the department $163,000 over that 31-year period in royalty and stamp prints. No other state remotely approaches those kind of numbers. Of course, no other state's Texas. I mean, it's something that we're incredibly, it is our corporate identity. You know, while it's not near what it used to be, it's still the most important thing in our corporate identity. And believe me, when you're in the art business in 2010, you need something positive to identify you, at least temporarily, if nothing else. This year's prints are, I'm going to start with the freshwater. I've tried for 4 years to get an artist to paint a catfish of any kind. I mean, what better offer can you make to an artist? You can paint any catfish you want. And John Dearman has painted a channel cat. And I don't think that's going to, you know, affect sales materially one way or the other, but clearly it's probably the number one game fish in Texas. And in fact, John has done 12, over the years, he's done 12 Texas stamp programs. All he's done at least one of every, in every category. And that's what kind of pushed him over the edge. I sort of told him that he owed it to us to do the catfish because he had got to do so many of the other ones. And John lives in Huntsville, Texas. He's really a approaching icon status as a Texas artist, and a good enough guy to paint a channel catfish. That may be the first painting ever of a channel catfish by anybody. I've certainly never seen one.
Yeah, everybody catches them, likes to eat them, but nobody wants a picture of them on the wall.
Can you imagine? And the saltwater stamp is by Randy McGovern. He's new to our stamp print program, but he's a very prominent stamp print artist. Lives in Atlanta, Georgia, by way of Louisiana, and we think he did a terrific job on the. You know, we really got two fish, trout, redfish. And, you know, we try to throw in a flounder and a billfish or whatever, but the bottom line is we always come back to redfish and trout. And the Upland stamp is by Joe Hartman. He's one of the three somewhat famous Hartman brothers that dominate the Texas duck, I mean the federal duck stamp competition for the last 20 years. Joe has also done our duck stamp. I'll say that for the his brother Bob is doing our duck stamp. The next painting is a painting by Al Barnes. Lives in Fulton, Texas, right next to Rockport, and Al, of course, is really probably as prominent artist as there is in Texas now. And the Specklebellies, the federal duck step judging was about a month ago, and I was busy laboring over a hot shotgun in Michigan and didn't really, I forgot that it happened. And when all the smoke cleared, Bob Hartman and his brother Jim tied in the federal duck stamp contest, and the brother Jim, who's done our duck stamp at least three times, won the federal duck stamp for the fourth time, and Joe was runner up. And he didn't really feel like that doing the Texas duck stamp was an appropriate consolation prize, but it's all he ended up with. They both painted Specklebelly geese for the federal. The federal designates what give you a very limited selection of subject matter. And he did standing. He did a standing goose, and his brother did two standing geese, and 2-1 over 1, I guess. But anyway, those guys are really famous guys, and I mean, they're the biggest names in the business. And, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
No, we just appreciate the program. I mean, this. Excuse me, Chairman, I interrupted, but glad you. Been coming down for 31 years.
I too.
And part of the outreach program, and I know the sales have dropped over the years, and I understand how tough, particularly the last couple of years, it's been. But
we talked about smarter.
I think about using these images also.
And when we went to an automated licensing program, that really, you know,
changed.
Wasn't the death knell. But you know, we're sort of on life support now. But you know, we still continue. Last year we paid the department $40,000, and you know, while that is, you know, in the total scheme of things, that's not too impressive, but it is $40,000, you know. And we love doing it, and it's always fun to get to work with Francis and Carter in the department, you know. I mean, something we're very proud of.
Good. Carter's excited about that catfish.
I imagine Carter's excited about that $40,000.
Yeah. Yeah, this next legislative session, any amount we're going to get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Is there any discussion by the commission? Any questions? Thank you very much
for
your presentation.
Thank you.
I'm sorry? Did you say you did the skimmer? Yeah, on the skimmer.
Who did the
Al Bourne.
So will there be a competition?
If there are no further questions or discussion, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 3, legislative preview and update. Mr. Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. It's probably a pretty good segue into it. I think, as all of you are aware, you know, we formally submitted our legislative appropriations request at the end of August. Also, we had our first budget hearing with members from the Legislative Budget Board, Senate Finance, House Appropriations, the Governor's Office, and Lieutenant Governor's Office. We talked about our legislative appropriations request. We talked about our exceptional items, and we also talked about the proposed 10% reduction schedule in the prioritized items that we had put forward as part of that submittal. I think it was a very good presentation. We got a lot of strong feedback from that. We continue to entertain lots of questions from the Legislative Budget Board, who were obviously busily working on preparing a proposed state budget. And so Gene and his team are very, very busy responding to questions about various and sundry departmental activities and programs as they are really looking in it. I would say, you know, probably certainly since I've been here and as Gene and others have said, it's been a long time since everybody's budget was under this much scrutiny and examination, so I think that just speaks to obviously the issues that the state faces. Also, you know, we need to be thinking about other issues that will likely be confronting the agency during the course of the session, and so I thought I'd run down a couple of kind of prioritized items that are likely to come up for the agency, and also other issues that I think will come up sort of organically and are of interest to various and sundry members that y'all should probably be aware of. You know, certainly a big issue for us that is looming on the horizon is the expiration of the freshwater fishing stamp. That's the $5 stamp. You know, that generates roughly $6.5 million a year. that is exclusively dedicated for the repair and renovation and construction of fish hatcheries. This is an absolutely essential funding stream for us to take care of our hatcheries, which are so critically important to our stock enhancement work that our fisheries biologists are involved in lakes and reservoirs around the state. We have got, I think as you all know, 5 inland fish hatcheries. A number of those were built back in the 30s. And so you can imagine the challenges of kind of keeping up with that infrastructure, whether it's pipes or pond liners or facilities. That infrastructure is a challenge for us, and anglers have been very, very supportive of this stamp. And when it was passed, it was put in place for a 10-year period and slated to sunset on September 1st, 2014. There's been a lot of recent discussion among angler partners and constituents about the specter of extending that stamp. I think a lot of them would be very interested in seeing the cap taken off that stamp and having it be in place just like our saltwater stamp or the upland game bird or migratory game bird stamp. Because again, I mean, this is an essential investment by our anglers into the quality of the fisheries in the state. So an important issue for the state. On the coastal side, we've talked a lot about the damage to the state's oyster reefs that came about as a function of Hurricane Ike. As you'll recall, you know, we lost nearly 8,000 acres of consolidated oyster reefs as a function of that storm and that huge deposition of silt on top of those. Our fisheries team, coastal fisheries team, has been working very busily with oyster fishermen on trying to dredge off some of that silt and to create new culch material in the bays where we could get spat attached to that and start regrowing those reefs. It's a very expensive process to get those established, very, very expensive. And so one of the things that, you know, certainly we've been acutely aware of is when oystermen are harvesting oysters from the bay, and after they take the oyster, what happens to the shell? You know, that's very valuable material that could go back into the bay and serve as substrate for us to rebuild those oyster stocks. You know, they're sold off, they go to landfills, they go out of state. We've had the statutory ability to get a program in place to replenish the bays with those oyster shells. There needs to be a funding stream to help pay for that, but I think it's very much in the best interest of our bays and estuaries, our oyster fishermen, our fisheries, and anybody who really cares about the health and vitality of the bays to figure out a much more cost-effective way to replenish those stocks. So keen issue of interest to a lot of conservation organizations such as CCA, and a lot of discussion going on with oystermen and others on that right now. On the administrative side, something I'll highlight, obviously y'all are aware of the parks that we operate, and also kind of the unique gift stores or concessions that we operate as part of those state parks. So somebody goes out to McKinney Falls or Bastrop or Pernalis Falls, you know, they oftentimes want some kind of memento from that park to take home with them. And so they want something that's special, that's unique, that's reflective of that experience. Our state purchasing requirements can be a bit of a challenge when we're trying to work with local vendors who produce things on a very, very small level that's unique to that site. State purchasing requirements with the appropriate competitive bidding also come with a lot of bulk purchasing and other requirements that are really more designed for kind of an agency level purchasing or state level purchasing in bulk. And that oftentimes precludes us from being able to work with local vendors to help realize things that we could then sell in our gift stores that I think would be of great value to our customers. So something that we're very interested in looking at and maybe getting some flexibility there. We've talked about just how invaluable our volunteers are to the management of our state parks. I think the last estimate I saw that on an average basis, you know, we get roughly 250 to 300 FTEs a year in terms of the volunteer hours mm-hmm. that are given back to our state parks. That's free labor. These are folks are there because they have an extraordinary volunteer ethic. But we rely on them to do a lot of duties. And, you know, some of those is needing to drive department vehicles. And the way the state's liability laws work is that If you're a volunteer, Chairman Holt, in a state park and you want to drive, or we would like for you to drive a state vehicle, you're going to have to be covered by your own personal insurance. The state liability insurance doesn't cover you as a volunteer, and that's something that we're interested in talking about and exploring with the legislature to see if we can get more protection for volunteers.
Now, can I stop you there on some of these things that we just talked about, like the last two? I mean, is this something you say you've already brought up with?
These are issues that we have talked a lot about internally. And prioritized. Okay. It's kind of issues that we wanted to report back to you that we think are important. We asked all of the divisions to really go through a thoughtful process and identify their highest priorities issues for the session. And so Harold and his team led that process, brought back a suite of ideas. Law enforcement is particularly good with coming up with proposals, but so are the other divisions in terms of helping us kind of think through things that would benefit the work of the agency. We kind of winnowed those down to a dozen that we think are high priorities, and I just wanted to kind of touch on a few of those. So, but ones that we think are really important to our business, and we've got representations from all divisions. But that's kind of the genesis of that.
Okay, and so the thought process, as you were thinking about this, was going into this legislature, which is obviously going to be focused on one thing, primarily deficit and
redistricting,
and of course redistricting, and so you feel these are the kind of things we can get legislators and their staffs to listen to.
Yeah, we absolutely went into that with a filter.
Okay.
About that, and what are the really important critical things for the mission and things that were reasonable. So, you know, there are other issues that we think and we've certainly heard are likely to come up in the session that can and will affect the agency that I think, you know, the commission should be mindful of. You know, certainly we have heard, you know, that some legislators are interested in revisiting the whole concept of allowing snake hunters to collect snakes and other reptiles off the state's roadways. And certainly that's an issue that we've been intimately involved in the past. A lot of public safety issues that our team is appropriately concerned about, and certainly some real questions about how and where and when we want our wardens to spend their time in the wee hours of the night when most of the snake collectors are out looking at rock collectors and such. But an important issue to some constituents and to some legislators, but we expect to see that come up. You know, right now I think y'all are aware of the fact that with an aerial depredation permit that's issued by the agency, landowners can hunt hogs or shoot hogs from a helicopter. They can't charge for that for sport hunting. We all know the issues with feral hogs in the state and just how damaging they are. There was a bill last session that proposed to allow for sport hunting of feral hogs from helicopters, in which individuals could pay for the privilege to do that. That bill was not passed, but I think there's certainly a good chance that could come up again in this session, and we'll raise some important questions about how we want to pursue that. We regularly get a lot of entreaties from different stakeholder groups that are interested in being granted free hunting and fishing licenses, and certainly demographics that are arguing for the merit of them receiving free licenses compared to other citizens in the state. And so I suspect we'll see certainly discussions on that front. And then, certainly last but not least, there has been a lot of work over the summer and this fall on an advisory panel that was chartered to look at boating safety recommendations and what else can be done to improve boater safety on Texas waters. You know, our game wardens are responsible for the state's waters and enforcing and handling water safety throughout the state. And so, team has been very, very involved in those discussions and what else could be done There's a representative panel of various interest groups involved in that, a lot of discussion. We expect some recommendations to come out of that, and I expect there'll be a lot of discussion on that. So that's a little bit of a flavor of things that we expect to see over the course of the session. There's a lot of other things there. I don't want to take up your time with too much of discussion, but just kind of wanted to give you some semblance of the flavor there. So be happy to take any questions anybody might have.
Yes, sir.
Last time, I think someone reported that we presented our natural agenda
That's correct. Yeah.
What was the reaction from them to our presentation and to our natural agenda?
Well, it's and Gene, you want to come up and out? Really, I'm not sure there was a real formal response to that. Certainly, it's been reviewed by the budget writers and looking at that in the context of preparing a starting place for the state budget. There hadn't been any kind of hearings on that. Say more kind of the informal day-to-day routine communication that happens, with Gene and Mike Jensen's team about questions that come out about that. So, Gene, do you want to elaborate on that? Is there anything else here?
Gene McCarty, Deputy Executive Director for Administration. We really did not present it per se. We submitted it as required in the appropriate time. We've gotten a number of, I guess, comments and or questions from the LBB about some of the issues in there, principally some of our challenges, identified challenges. We try to make natural agenda tie very closely to what our LB or what our LAR is going to suggest in terms of exceptional item requests. So we try to identify what our challenges are and then come back with a funding request in the LAR. And so we've gotten some questions as to how the issues that we identified tie to the exceptional item request, but that's about it.
Okay. Second question is, at one point we've had discussion about trying to facilitate credit card, use of credit cards to purchase licenses, and I've forgotten what else, but I think you said in the past that we were precluded by law, that we needed approval from the comptroller's office to use credit cards.
That is correct.
Is there any chance of that? Among these items that you're, the issues that you're talking about, if we can try to get approval to use, that our constituents can use credit cards to facilitate whatever we want to sell or are selling?
We brought that issue up at last session, and it has a fairly significant fiscal note to it in terms of the cost to the state. And really it's a cost to GR. And so it didn't go anywhere last session. We still have it in our pocket this session. If there's a opportunity, we will try to get it in there, but it is going to have a fiscal note on it, and the word we're being told is if you bring anything up here that has a fiscal note on it, it's DOA.
But does it have a fiscal note if you make the purchaser pay the processing fee so that there is no impact on GR?
That does not create a fiscal note.
I sure hope we'll try to explore that. I just think it's a way to make us more user friendly, and as long as we require the credit card user to pick up any processing charge, mm-hmm. I don't know why we wouldn't do that.
You're talking about a convenience fee that would be part of the process.
Yes.
and part of the fee that somebody knows going in that it's going to be this amount, and if they want to use that for convenience, that's just the cost of doing business.
If you try to buy guns from certain people over the internet through gun brokers, so they'll also have 3% charge for credit cards as opposed to paying by check. But at least it enables somebody who wants to make a purchase right then.
Right.
To make it even quicker.
Ask you a question. Are there any other agencies that would have a need? I mean, is that part of the problem? Is it just not that many other agencies that would the use of a credit card would help? So
well,
we can't get any momentum from or any other to help agents.
Well, it's the difference between GR and dedicated funds. So there are some. I think there are other agencies that could use it, but you know they're already working out of GR as opposed to. With us, it is a deduction from GR to reimburse us for our costs.
Yeah, so it ends up being a net loser.
Right. Yeah. That's the way the comptroller looks at it. It's a loss to general revenue.
Yes, sir. Mr. Smith, Dana, do you have a question?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I just wanted to maybe hear your comments on the expectations of our law enforcement division along the border now with the fact that we were catapulted into the national news here for the last several weeks and anything that we can do differently legislatively preempt anything before the session starts?
Well, I think the thing that it's important for everybody to remember are a couple of things, Commissioner. I mean, one, you know, our law enforcement team is here for conservation law enforcement purposes. I mean, they enforce our fish and game laws, our water safety laws, our environmental laws, but they're commissioned peace officers to enforce all laws of the state of Texas. And the reality is our wardens are out there every single day and come across violations of the penal code, and those are not things that they can ignore. Our wardens are also very, very well equipped to handle the unique challenges that are presented along the border because of the rural nature as part of that, the activities that go on off the pavement, on the water. And so there's been a real dose of confidence and trust invested in our game wardens to play a critical role of having more law enforcement agents strategically stationed along the border who are there, you know, ostensibly to help with the agency's mission. But while doing that, they serve as a force multiplier. They're working appropriately with their partners in other local and state and federal law enforcement officers. And as we have confronted the challenges that are plaguing places like Falcon Lake, there is no doubt that our game wardens are front and center in addressing these very real public safety issues that have emerged. And the good news is that our team has very much risen to the occasion, and so there's a lot of confidence in them. And that's very positive. And so, you know, we're seeing appropriate investments being made to help facilitate that. And so, and I think we will continue to see that grow where those opportunities present itself. You know, in our legislative appropriations request, we have asked for instance, in-vehicle automation, in-vehicle computer systems for our game wardens and some of our park peace officers. They're patrolling in very remote areas of the state. This gives them the ability not only for us to know exactly where they are, but also to do real-time queries on suspects and individuals that they are coming into contact. I mean, it is absolutely a best standard for law enforcement. We also have some significant investments in communication infrastructure that we need to support our law enforcement team and the other members of our agency that are scattered out in the hinterlands and simply to comply with new federal communication requirements. So I think the conversation about the border is absolutely going to be there during the session, Commissioner, and I think our law enforcement team will be in a very, very good position to help play an integral role in part of the state's overall law enforcement efforts, and it's a real credit to Pete and his team. So I feel very, very strongly and good about how positioned the agency is for that.
Can I add to that?
Yes, sir.
And where are we on the training side of it, though? Okay, with now our, you know, as you have new cadets and you've got our new training program over at Hamilton, because let's face it, this is a different aspect to the mission, this kind of law enforcement. So are we then now training cadets, additional type of training? I don't know what it would mean or take or whatever, but I mean, what are we doing? Because that's been one of my big worries to the point where I've actually discussed it with the governor, is, you know, you're asking us to have help and have more our people help along the border and essentially get involved with all these various issues that are happening along the border. And we know there are many of them. What are we then doing to train so that we make sure that people are out there. What I'm asking, have the right training, equipment. We talked about equipment, training, and other things to do that kind of work.
Yes, sir. For the record, Colonel Peter Flores, Director of Law Enforcement. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, obviously training, but when we look at training as a whole, I was asked this very same question in Senate Finance a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Were our wardens on the border trained more than the wardens in the rest of the state? And my answer to that, and my answer today, is the same, in that we train all of our wardens the same, whether they're in Fort Worth or on the border, to meet the challenges of law enforcement in general today. The risks are high everywhere, and so appropriately, our training is such that we feel that we have one of the best, most comprehensive training programs in the country. Our state begins with community policing policy, which is very important, which makes law enforcement effective. I think that's probably one of the things that makes us most effective, especially in rural Texas and on the border, when compared to other agencies, especially larger ones, where they lose that component and thereby their effectiveness and their touch with the community. That trust, that place, is all, that's where it starts. As far as actual policing, again, our academy in the last two classes in their exam, in their TCLOS exam, which is their licensure, was 100% passing. That's the whole, both classes, for example. That's extraordinary. And so the police component, as far as the basic policing, we believe we're covering very well, but we can always improve. Our training as far as officer safety is, and safety as a whole, but especially our officer safety component, our professional policing, is our simunitions training is done by all officers. That puts you in a real scenario with what they may face in the field. There's nothing that they absolutely don't know what's going to happen, but they use the training and the equipment that they have to be able to respond appropriately to come out of a gunfight intact. Our equipment, I believe your game wardens are some of the best equipped game wardens in the country, and we've done that working very proactively through various avenues, financial avenues that were always out there, but that we've tapped into to be able to provide good equipment in our vehicles, radios on their person, ballistic vests that are the latest ballistic vests, including level 3A and 4 on the border, which take 223 rounds. Hopefully we get those for all over the state, but the border in particular, those wardens will have the ballistic vests that are 3A or level 4, which and as well as required wear of ballistic armor. I mean, the days when you could assume nothing would happen, they were always here. Things will happen. You can't predict when an incident is going to occur. Their weapon training, they have M4 rifle. Mm-hmm. Our patrolmen carry automatic rifles. With the EOTech site, which is a hologram site, it's there, and then the training in that is very intensive, very comprehensive. Their Glocks are continually upgraded. We carry Glock pistols. Their training in that, we qualify more than what's required by the minimum by TCLOS. Training is ongoing on tactics. In the academy, and in fact through in-service training, just because you graduate doesn't mean that education stops there. We have continual in-service training, which is an integral part of our academy, is not only to train cadets, but to continue to train our wardens in the field in the latest tactics. We have a force continuum training, which the wardens went through last year, updates in search and seizure. It's pretty much as comprehensive with patrol tactics. Of this year's, for example, this year's emphasis for our statewide in-service will be Marine and Marine tactics for every game warden. And those are that every game warden will go through it. That provides a uniform, comprehensive program. Because we're so mobile, we go everywhere. We do anything. Just because you're assigned on the border doesn't mean if you're living in Houston, you might not go work on the border, but it can happen anywhere. So comprehensively, our force is well equipped, well rounded. The boats we've acquired are some of the best boats of their kind in the world, and they require intensive training, and they're very specific. Their electronics on them are of the very world-class best. You can see underwater, you can see in the dark. They're very tactical in their nature. We have a large fleet of those vessels now that we didn't have just a few years ago, for example, and that training that goes along with them. But what's more important is also having our wardens be doing our jobs, doing what we're supposed to be, where we're supposed to be, but to be able to communicate with our partners in the state and federal level and the local level. That communication, that integration is a big component of officer safety. Certainly as we move into the future, with the in-car computer system that provides you for real-time data, real-time intelligence sharing. We have a place at the Fusion Center here in Austin, which gives us immediate information to a very vast database. Anything that we find, we report. Anything any other agency finds, they report, and we're able to access that, which contributes to our effectiveness and officer safety. So I can go on a number of things that we're doing on this very issue, but certainly we can always improve. I believe that with this in-car computer, we need to have it. Our radio communication system has to be integrated, and that's a bit a larger issue on a state scale of interoperability that will go into the billions of dollars. But for us, our radio towers are an important part of that. Individual trackers, being able to track our wardens real time, that where our dispatchers can look on a screen and see where they're at 24/7, certainly is part of that component. But working with George Rios in IT, there's always Plan A and there's always Plan B and there'll always be Plan C. But the end result will be providing a comprehensive program which provides the very best conservation law enforcement officers in the country. That's what we want to do.
Good.
Hope I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. Well, and I appreciate it because it's been obviously worrisome to the point. As I said, we've talked about it off and on for the last few years with the leadership downtown relative to being asked to do these things. And I understand that you train all your wardens the same, whether they're in Houston or whether they're on Falcon Lake. But the issue, because we move around, but the issue is we are being asked to do more of certain types of missions that we weren't in the past. And so I just want to make sure that you feel, and your leadership feels that we're keeping up with that. Because at the end of the day, then all we're doing is, I mean, obviously something that happened, like happened in Falcon Lake a few weeks ago, doesn't normally happen, you know, on Lake Sam Rayburn. Okay, it's just not going to be. And so you've got, a mixed mission in a sense, if you just take those two lakes and compare them, of the situation of being on the border.
In fact, Mr. Chairman, we deal with a number of issues all throughout the state. We deal with left-wing groups, anywhere from the Piney Woods, the Aryan Brotherhood, is very active in East Texas. We run into them regularly, not only on the state parks, but also in the national forests. It may not be elevated to the degree of the border, but certainly running into criminal elements, organized gangs, narcotics, methamphetamine. These are things that while doing our job, we're running into that are very well funded, equally ruthless. And that's which requires us to be trained.
That's a good point.
And they do exist, but we do run into murders, we do run into kidnappings, we do run into huge meth labs while out doing our job, going through a hunting lease just last week, a big meth lab in the Grimes, Walker County line, a very, very huge one. We run into like a pot growing operations on the White Oak Wildlife Management Area just a few years ago. These are things that happen in the interior of Texas, but certainly, but the difference is that we still have the rule of law here in Texas and the United States, and there's no rule of law on the Mexican side. And it's just a reminder that all of us working together under the Texas program, each of us doing our specific function, whether it's you're a highway patrolman checking for driver's licenses on the highway or a game warden checking for fishing licenses on the river, that we all have our particular role. With what's important is that we work together to keep the rule of law in Texas and to make sure that we don't have the chaos of Mexico.
I'd like to make a comment while you're there, Colonel. I want to thank you, really, and compliment you and your whole team, as you were unexpectedly plummeted into the national news with what happened in Lake Falcon. I think that it was handled with tremendous integrity and respect and grace, and everybody on the team just really came forward and rose to the occasion, and the notoriety, as I travel around the state, it has created much more notoriety of what the wardens are doing and created more awareness for people in the interior now realizing that the face of the game warden has changed through now our homeland security issues and through our border security issues. And compliments to you and your whole law enforcement team for standing up and taking the call and doing it with the highest of integrity and skill and going forward. And I think it is important that at all times we are here to support the safety and the training of the whole law enforcement. So on a personal level, on my part, anything that I can do to help you guys, I really appreciate it. Brought, like I said, national news to you all and everything in a very complimenting way. And so I just want to thank you on my part.
Thank you, Commissioner. But certainly the credit goes to our folks on the ground, the ones that are out there every day doing the job diligently and believing in our mission of conservation and public safety. Captain Cervantes there in Zapata done an exemplary job of representing this agency. We hope that you all are pleased with the professionalism that he displayed and your equipment and your game wardens operating not only there but everywhere in Texas. And hopefully that is the expectation we have of them, and hope that we can continue to deliver that while doing our job and keeping Texas safe at the same time. So,
Thank you, Colonel Flores. Yes.
This may be on later on the agenda. Are we going to get a report on the threats, a follow-up report on the threats that were made against wardens and park police officers that were discussed at the last meeting?
I think Graham Jones is going to provide an update next on internal affairs case report, and so I think Graham would be well positioned to answer any questions you have about that. So,
thank you,
Mr. Colonel. Thank you, Colonel. The incident at Falcon Lake has really opened the doors for a lot of discussion on a lot of these things, but certainly appreciate Colonel Flores' leadership in making safety a priority for our game wardens, and also appreciate the fact that a lot of our state leadership has been down there to firsthand look at the situation. A lot of times when you see things on the news, it's not quite the way it is. I know that there are no cruise ships on the lake. I don't know, every time one of the networks talked about like going back, there was a big cruise ship in the back, and I don't think it's there. So it is important to what you've been doing has been real important, and we appreciate it. Any other questions or comments? Committee item number 4, internal affairs case update. Major Jones.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. We're not going to conduct an investigation into the catfish print today, but we are going to give you a brief synopsis as per House Bill 3391, which was our sunset legislation, as this is required by the recent sunset legislation. Basically, our staff, it's myself and two captains, Joe Carter and Captain Chris Davis, one administrative technician, Patty Vela. We have a multifaceted role in internal affairs. Obviously, we investigate criminal and some administrative allegations. We manage the department complaint system. We also look into threat assessments and risk analysis that goes hand-in-hand with our executive protection team, off-site gatherings at state parks, etc. And then we also train and educate. We travel around the state. We go to regional meetings for law enforcement and state parks, other divisions, and we also teach at the Game Warden Academy and to the new park peace officers as well. As far as the FY 2010 case breakdown, we had a total of 121 cases. 25 were criminal and 96 were non-criminal. I'm going to break that down to you by division. We had communications, we had one case, and these are our criminal cases. These are our formal cases. Infrastructure division, we had two. Law enforcement, we have 12. In state parks, we had 9. We had one other. The other was actually a license, a vendor. It's very common for law enforcement in state parks because those people have the most interaction with the public. Obviously, we're going to have the largest number of cases in those divisions. A three-year summary, as far as our case summary, when you look at this, our average caseload is primarily the same. We did have a spike in 2009 on our criminal cases, but if you look at our long-term stats, we've had spikes before. Actually, I think in 2009 we had 50 criminal cases. 2010 we had half that, we had 25. But the total number of informal cases was 104, 103, and 96 respectively for 2010, which is pretty much on par with our running average on cases. So although it looks like we had a spike for criminal cases in 2009, we have had that many before.
What's an example of a non-criminal?
A non-criminal case, they're referrals, basically, Chairman. Someone would call up and say that a game warden was rude, or a park peace officer was rude. We're going to refer that back to the division. Sometimes we'll look a little bit deeper if we identify a trend. We'll look a little bit deeper in that. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think you had a question, Commissioner, on threats.
Well, in the August meeting, mm-hmm. I forgot who it was in detail. Maybe you mentioned that we'd had several wardens, I think, in the Lake Falcone area.
Right.
We've been threatened and some park people. What to the extent it should be discussed, that we stay on top of that and make sure our folks are being...
Absolutely, yes, sir. One example, the most recent example that involved a game warden. Game warden received a telephone call that could be construed as a threat. Within one day, we had traced that call with assistance from the Fusion Center. We found out who made the call, and we made an arrest within 36 hours. And that's something that we take extremely seriously. We are on top of that. We work hand-in-hand with law enforcement and park peace officers as well. So that's something that we do take very seriously, yes, sir.
But is this an isolated incident, or did it happen?
That particular case was isolated, yes, sir. But you know, we'll run into I would say an average of 3 to 5 threats against our officers every year. It's mainly due to retaliation. After someone makes an arrest, someone will try to retaliate against that officer or make some threats towards that officer. We'll investigate that and take appropriate action. But we don't have a large number of those, no, sir.
We are, when there is a retaliatory threat, we're referring that to the district?
Absolutely, yes, sir. We file formal criminal charges on, if we can, we're going to file formal criminal charges. Yes, sir.
Yeah, and Commissioner, my experience with that is if there is a threat made, you know, Graham and his team drop everything they're doing and work on that. So
yes,
the
sir.
Issue about making sure that our colleagues are appropriately protected, irrespective of what division is. Really their highest priority. So do an extraordinary job on that front.
Yes, sir. Any other questions?
Thank you, Graham.
Right.
Chairman Holt, I'd like to discuss the oversight of Internal Affairs just briefly and maybe...
Sure.
Internal Affairs reports to the Finance Committee, but this is the kind of report that we've been doing, and I think Ralph's question is important in the sense that we may want an opportunity to get a little bit more information, and I realize that because of the sensitivity of some of the
yes,
cases
sir.
That may need to be done in closed session, but I'm just wondering if we should at least consider having a subcommittee or somebody that can get a little bit more information than just a summary of cases for the sake of saying that we are providing adequate oversight to Internal Affairs.
What did come out of Sunset? I'm trying to think.
The primary change was that it gave us statutory authority over original jurisdiction with criminal cases.
Right.
Also, we report directly to the commission and to the executive director, and that I have to get permission or approval to proceed with the case from either the commission or the executive director. Those are the primary changes. And Mr. Smith and I do discuss cases. When we take a case on, I seek that approval and we move forward.
Right.
I think in answer to your question, the change was that it had to report directly to the commission, and I think history has shown we've gotten adequate information on significant matters. I think it's been cleared up just for the record. We haven't just been given lip service to this requirement.
No, I think Dr. Falcone is just worried about, if things continue growing. I mean, if you're saying a subcommittee or an individual commissioner maybe to kind of be alongside, walk me through what...
I think that maybe if there was an opportunity, for example, Gene and I and some of the members that of the department that participated in finances will meet before the meeting.
Right.
And if any of the commissioners might be interested in a particular aspect of something that's going to be reported, to have that opportunity given at that level, so that if there's a specific case about a game warden that had a complaint against them, that it could be described in more detail. I'm just wondering if we should not afford the commission that opportunity, that they could get a little bit more information if they needed to have some.
Sure.
That was more structured other than informal. I guess we can always call Graham and ask.
Yeah, we'd be happy to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
what you're talking about, more structured, informal. Okay.
Just
sure.
A thought.
Yeah,
if anybody...
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about it. Think about it. Because informally, and certainly any commissioner has a right to talk to Graham directly
at
any time about anything.
Yes, sir.
Doesn't have to go through the executive director or anything. I mean, that's part of this whole... Sunset setup, so certainly everybody feel free to do that, but I understand what you're saying. Should we do something on a more formal basis? I mean, I think we have to see how you coordinate that and figure it out.
Sure.
Commissioner?
I've got just a question for my clarification. These 25 criminal cases now, are these criminal cases that you now refer for further?
Yes, sir. What we do is we will refer cases to the district attorney if it meets a threshold. You know, if there's evidence of a crime, we're going to refer that to the appropriate prosecutorial jurisdiction. And then what we do is the DA will either accept charges or will issue a letter of declination of prosecution.
So that's 121 total cases that were referred for?
You're talking about which? Let's see here. Yeah, we had 121 total cases. The criminal cases were just we had 25 criminal cases. Of those criminal cases, we actually referred 7 to the DA, the appropriate DA's office that met the threshold of
out of the
25. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Is it an impediment to your performance to have to report any or all these investigations to Carter or to the commission?
No, sir. It's not at all. We do have a computerized program now, and the data is relatively easy to mine. We track the cases on a web-based program, but it's fine. And you guys have been very supportive. I appreciate the support.
Seems it could get. If you have to move quickly on a particular issue, I would hate to have you not be able to move in the way that you needed to because you were unable to get approval.
Yes, sir, and I appreciate that. And Mr. Smith and I have when something breaks down that's very serious or we have a serious allegation, example would be a threat against an officer. I've never had a situation where I could not get a hold of Mr. Smith, and if I couldn't get a hold of Mr. Smith, I would call the chairman or a commissioner to proceed.
Okay. Just want to make sure we
yes, sir.
Do what we need to do.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point because I never want my schedule to be an impediment to somehow to Graham and his team being able to proceed on an investigation. Graham's got all my numbers. We talked it.
You didn't know we're going to build an apartment.
Right.
Every hour in a 24-hour period point. So it's I take that responsibility very seriously.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Have you had any what you felt like was pushback from any of the prosecutorial folks when you presented a case that you thought ought to be prosecuted?
No, sir. We I have not seen that. We've received several letters of declination recently, and the prosecutors were complimentary of the work that Captain Carter and Captain Davis did. I have not experienced that. And then locally here, we will deal with the Travis County Public Integrity Unit, which has their prosecutor in house, and we have a good relationship with them, so we haven't had any pushback.
But in those cases where the prosecutor declined,
yes, sir,
the case. What was the difference?
Well, it's not that we're selling the case to the prosecutor. What we'll do is we'll compile our case report and we'll send it to the prosecutor. And what we'll do is we have a matrix that we'll look at. And if the crime could have occurred or if the allegation could have occurred, we're not saying it did or it didn't. We're going to send it to the prosecutor for independent review. Now, that's going to include our findings. And our findings would be that, you know, the game warden or the park peace officer, whoever it is, was not found to have violated policy or was not found to have violated the law in the criminal example. So we're going to put our findings in there that we believe that the game warden was truthful, and here's the evidence and here are the statements, et cetera. And the prosecutor will review that, but we let him know that it's an independent review. If he has any questions, he can follow up with us. Well, oftentimes we've discussed the case with their investigators as well. So we're not selling the case to them. We're just presenting the case to them and letting them make their own decision. And we did have an indictment this year as well on a case. So, and we've had indictments in the past. The short version would be that for the most part our officers are exemplary and although occasionally we do get an indictment, for the most part the allegations are unfounded.
Thank you, Major Jones.
Yes, sir.
Chairman, hope this committee has completed its business.
Okay.